hardcore ukulele intros always make me hungry. So I thought I would stop by at Kabuki Japanese Restaurant in Woodland Hills, which is just north of Los Angeles, California, as they claim to have some of the best sushi in the valley and don't seem to mind when anthropologists wander in wanting to film themselves eat. So let's give it a try. Today I ordered a spider roll, which is crunchy, soft-shelled crab, and freshwater eel sushi, which has a sweet sauce, salmon eggs, and some albacore sushi, which I have with a lot of wasabi and ginger. The staff here are friendly, the food did live up to the hype, and I'm sure I'll be back. Now would be a good time to subscribe if you haven't already, and make sure to click the bell to receive notifications. Thank you to those that have been sharing these videos. I appreciate it very much. With that, let's hit the road. The thing about sushi in California is that it can get kind of expensive, and so can the parking at the shore, which is why I came to this special beach with free parking. Probably free because you need to practically risk your life to get down to the water, but I'll be fine. Anthropology can be risky and dangerous, especially if you've had sake with your sushi, which is a Japanese fermented rice alcohol. That tastes really good, heated up and warm, like tea. But luckily, I only had water today. Now that I'm down here, I can understand why the surfers don't care much for this beach. It's pretty rocky. Maybe I'll just pay the parking fee next time, or at least wear something other than slippers. Okay, it looks like I made it down in one piece. Today, I wanted to talk a little bit about astrotheology. The word itself speaks to the influence of stars on religion. And we all know that because of the rotation and movement of the earth, we have repeating patterns in the sky, with the most obvious being the day and the years, because they happen frequently, so we can observe the cyclical and changing pattern of the seasons or aspects of day and night. Of course, the ancients were aware of much larger cycles, such as what Plato called the Great Year, a 25,900-year precession of the equinox, where there are 12 ages, roughly 2,200 years each, where different ages are said to embody different aspects of nature, the same way that different annual seasons do. To that effect, there were even longer astrological cycles, particularly documented in the writings from ancient India, which not only predicted events such as periodic global cataclysms, but also spoke of golden ages, which followed periods of degradation and cultural decline. One 20th century student of these ancient teachings, which were preserved in India, was Maximin Portas, born in France in 1905, and a convert to Hinduism. She was instrumental in the early New Age thought about preparing for the end of the Kali Yuga, the last of the four ages the world goes through according to Hindu scriptures. As a young child, she learned French and English from her parents, then taught herself modern Greek and some ancient Greek. She became fluent in eight languages: English, French, Greek, Italian, German, Icelandic, Hindi, and Bengali, and had a knowledge of many others. She also earned two master's degrees in philosophy and chemistry, and a PhD in philosophy from the University of Lyons, and had a vast knowledge of religion and history, particularly ancient history. But then she abandoned her academic life, underwent a spiritual crisis at the end of her studies, and as a self-described nationalist of every nation, She embraced National Socialism in 1929 in Palestine and went to India in 1932 to research the esoteric Aryan religion for herself, soon changing her name to Savitri Devi. Savitri is one of the Sanskrit names for the sun, and Devi means goddess. After changing her name, she converted to Hinduism and dedicated herself in freeing the subcontinent from both British imperialism and from all universalistic ideologies, such as Islam, communism, and liberal democracy, as well as Christianity, which she condemned as an anti-Aryan faith. According to Aryan tradition, history moves in cycles, beginning with a golden age, or age of truth, and decline from that point until one reaches the nadir, or the fourth age, the dark age, or Kali Yuga, in which evil and falsehood reign, and at that point, the forces of decay expire from their own corruption, and a new golden age dawns. According to Hindu tradition, the present Kali Yuga will be ended, and the next golden age will be inaugurated by the 10th avatar of Vishnu, Kalki. I won't go into who she thought Kalki was, but Savitri Devi died on October 22, 1982, at a friend's house in England. Her ashes were laid to rest with full fascist honors.
We're on the trail of a European woman who came here in the 1930s on a kind of spiritual journey. She learned Indian languages, took an Indian name, married a Brahmin, and made India her home. But she wasn't on some hippie quest for enlightenment and good hash. In 1945, Savitri Devi came here to the festival of Kali, the blue-skinned Hindu goddess of destruction and rebirth, to heal a broken heart.
I took part in the festival like a frantic person.
The women smeared their hands and faces with red and purple on that occasion. I smeared myself too. I did what they did. And I can see myself too in the Kaligarh temple in Calcutta, in front of the statue with the drums beating and resounding in me. The Nuremberg trial was on at that time. Mother, dark blue mother, avenge them. Avenge them. Avenge them, the martyrs of Nuremberg.
Avenge them, the martyrs of Nuremberg.
You heard her right, the martyrs of Nuremberg. Savitri was here to mourn the fall of the Third Reich and fortify her faith that National Socialism would rise again. She believed that if her Führer had won the war, he could have ended the Kali Yuga, the dark age of Hindu mythology, ushering in a golden Aryan future. Savitri's nephew, veteran left-wing journalist Sumanta Banerjee, is worried by echoes of his aunt's views in modern Indian politics.
Why is Savitri Devi relevant for India now? It is because her disciples are ruling India today. The members of the present Modi-led BJP government have imbibed Savitri Devi's ideology.
Sumanta's talking about Hindu nationalism, the belief that India is an essentially Hindu country, another element of Savitri's faith, and now the official ideology of India's ruling party. Savitri was born Maximiani Portas to an English mother and Greek-Italian father in France in 1905. As a young woman, she was swept up by Greek nationalism and its dream of uniting all Greeks in a single enlarged state. Hitler, she felt, unjustly treated by the victors of World War I, wanted the same for his people.
And much more meaning the freedom of Europe, the freedom of the Aryan race.
And much more meaning the freedom of Europe, the freedom of the Aryan race. He's the one who's going to free us from all that. He's my leader too, mein Führer.
Mein Führer.
Savitri travelled to India in the 1930s to look for the pagan world displaced from Europe by Christianity and was dazzled by the colours and sounds of a Hindu festival celebrating Rama and Sita. For her, the ceremony proved that Hinduism honours the Aryan race above all.
I saw this crowd all around the sacred tank, under the full moon, a violet sky, beautiful. The crowd of dark people honouring the Aryan conqueror who presented white, honouring him with praise, with flowers, with a whole ceremony. And I thought, here you are, Non-Aryans in crowds come and worship as a god, an Aryan king of old. That's lovely. I was proud of my race.
I was proud of my race.
Savitri married a man she thought of as a fellow Aryan, the Indian Brahmin Ashit Mukherjee, and became part of his family. Early travellers to India noticed that Indian and European languages have many words in common. Enlightenment scholars speculated that Europeans and Indians were descended from common ancestors who lived somewhere in the north and eventually labelled this putative people Aryans.
The dream of my life is to integrate...
The dream of my life is to integrate Hitlerism into the old Aryan tradition to show that it is really a resurgence of the original tradition. Not Indian, not European, but Indo-European. It comes from those days when the Aryans were one people near the North Pole.
Savitri's fantasy of an Aryan utopia somewhere near the North Pole, presumably before the ice and the polar bears arrived, comes from an early Indian nationalist called Tilak. The word Arya first appears in ancient Sanskrit texts. Historian Romila Thapar has been studying them for more than half a century.
The connotation is the person who's to be respected. And it referred very much to people who spoke the Aryan language. And so Indian nationalism latched onto this and said the Aryan race was the progenitor of what we today call Hindus. So that gives legitimacy to the Hindus as being the people who gave us our civilization. The Hindu majority has Aryan ancestors, the others, the minorities, don't. This is essentially a Hindu culture. The Muslims have no role in it. It's a Hindu civilization.
In the years before independence, it wasn't unusual for Indians to admire Hitler. Some kept little shrines to him beside their household gods. But few continued the cult, as Savitri did. For Savitri Devi, history's victims were the Germans. After the Reich's defeat, she returned to Europe, carrying in her mind the four-armed dark blue goddess of destruction and rebirth.
She went to Germany in 1948 and started passing out flyers and leaflets to the occupied Germans in the Western Zone.
I'm for a multiracial world in which each race keeps to itself, in harmony with the other races. Like in a garden, you have flower beds with roses and flower beds with carnations and irises and different other flowers, and they don't intermarry.
People want to be racialist, but they are told that racialist is naughty, is wicked, evil, against the tide of history, that we've all got to come together like the Coca-Cola advert. I wish the world could be in perfect harmony with choirs of teenagers, all races singing their little hearts out about this idealism, utter tosh. But that's the moral, psychological atmosphere that's been created by international big business. They want the white peoples of the earth to be dissolved.
So what do they then do instead?
They vote for things like Brexit. They vote for people like Trump in order to revolt. It's going to be an incremental process where we reassert ourselves.
Savitri Devi too thought it would take a long time for the Aryan race to reassert itself. Eventually, the end of the Dark Age, or Kali Yuga, would come in a fiery cataclysm.
It'll take centuries. It'll be done slowly.
It will take centuries. It will be done slowly. Every person will contribute to it more or less. It will not be done in this age, what we call in India the Kali Yuga, the Dark Age. When, after the Third or Fourth World War, I don't know, there will be a new world, fewer people.
The position of the right today is we're in a battle for the culture.
While Savitri Devi remains a controversial figure, as well as a largely forgotten one, her disdain for communism and other religious attempts to cover up ancient esoteric knowledge below a culturally Marxist veneer is still shared by many, although to a large degree limited to secret societies, mystery schools, and other occult orders. The antagonism towards Christianity, for example, is not aimed at events that allegedly took place 2,000 years ago, but to organizations that sprung up centuries later, such as the Catholic Church, which preached forced collectivism while burning, torturing, and executing any dissidents, for example, the Cathars or Templars, both of whom brought their guarded alchemical wisdom into Europe from places like the Levant, Middle East, Mesopotamia, and Indus Valley. Islam had a similar effect, where the conquered civilization is made to give up their prior cultural and ethnic identity, traditions, and spiritual practices handed down over many millennia. Another controversial historical figure is Albert Pike, a revered 33rd degree Freemason, who wrote considerably on ancient religions, particularly those pertaining to the ancient Aryans or ancient Persian and Indians, as told to us in this excerpt from a lecture by another 33rd degree honorary Mason, Manly P. Hall, in a lecture titled The Secret Persian Wisdom. The footage is from a walking tour of Nuremberg, Germany. I hope you enjoy it.
Now, in his researches into the Persian religion, Pike takes an attitude which perhaps is rather important to us. It might mean that before we get through with it, we'll spend a good deal of the evening on his attitude, but I think it is one that is essentially valuable. And strangely enough, he does not make this basic concept from a quotation from the Avesta, or one of the sacred books of the Persians, but from the Phaedo of Plato. He quotes Socrates, where Socrates says of the great initiatory institutions of the ancients, "It well appears that those who established the mysteries or secret assemblies of the initiates were no contemptible personages, but men of great genius, who in the early ages strove to teach us, under enigmas, that he who shall go to the invisible region without being purified will be precipitated into the abyss, while he who arrives there, purged of the stains of this world and accomplished in virtue, will be admitted to the dwelling place of the deity. The initiated are certain to attain to the company of the gods." This is from Socrates. Now, this is basically the premise upon which a very large part of his Avestan researches are based. First of all, then, let us try to restore his thinking. According to Pike, the researches in the early and basic religions of the Persians have led him to certain conclusions. One is that what we call the stream of the ancient Persian wisdom is one of the earliest streams of religious knowledge in the world. That it probably goes back far enough so that Pike says in the opening of his lectures on the Aryas, referring to the Rig Veda, he says, the second oldest book in the world. He does not at that point name the oldest, but from the general consensus of his thinking, he does not believe necessarily that the Avestas are the oldest, but he believes that the stream of tradition, which later became embodied in the Avestic literature, is one, if not the earliest, certainly the earliest that we can identify, of the great wisdom religious systems of the world. Now, Pike apparently had some reservations concerning the interpretation of the Persian sacred writings by the Persians themselves. He seems to have taken the ground that the ancient Persian writings are not much more available to the average modern believer today, and are not available in very much better condition than the sacred writings of most other great peoples. In other words, he takes the attitude that there is a peculiar and strange dark curtain that has fallen over all religions, that this curtain fell at some undetermined date, and he likes to symbolize it by the fact that each religion of the world passes through the experience of losing the key to its own doctrine. that this key becomes lost. The books don't become lost. The descent of the hierarchs, the priests and the teachers, this descent does not seemingly cease. But there seems to be a point in all the religions of men where certainty fades away, and where in the place of certainty man falls into opinion. And in the place of assurance of things, he falls into interpretation, about which there is an endless divergence of opinion. And Tite takes the point that wherever there is a tremendous division of opinion, there is a poverty of fact, because we are not divided on any matter in which we are certain. We are divided by our uncertainties, particularly in matters of religion and philosophy. And if the primordial religion of man was available in its original pristine beauty, Pike takes the ground that probably no one would resent it or oppose it, but that all down through time there has been a falling away from the power of exactitude, and that in this great drift of ages, marked by the destruction of ancient works, by the scattering of peoples, by the gradual interchange of racial beliefs and doctrines, that the purities of the lines of descent of tradition have gradually been corrupted. So that today, as he expresses it in his own words, religion has gradually moved into the position of a powerful ethical structure of believing, and that religion today is measured by the individual's acceptances of certain things as true, the acceptances of certain ethical codes, about which there seems to be less division of opinion than upon more abstract theological questions. Thus men still are more or less agreed as to the nature of honesty, but they are not at the moment in very solid agreement as to the nature of first cause, or any of these great abstractions which mark the foundations or beginnings of practically all of the world's faiths. Thus Pike takes the attitude that there is a key which opens the structure of these ancient teachings, and that this key is lost. If not lost, it is unfortunately mislaid. It is not available to us when we most need it and most want it. And in the place of this key, men have fashioned many keys, and some of them seem to fit fairly well. But it was Pike's opinion that these keys did not actually turn the lock correctly, that they did not make available the point which is of the greatest basic interest or the greatest basic value. Pike then points out that his assumption is based upon a number of points which he considers to be highly relevant. He sees in a certain central area involving the great complex of Persian Aryan peoples a center from which, radiating outward in almost all directions, streams of culture flowed like rivers of life to make fertile the religions and cultures of a great many peoples. He is convinced from his study of ancient languages and ancient teachings that there are vestiges, evidences, fragments, perpetuations of this ancient Iranian faith to be found in almost all of the surviving religions of the world. He believes also that to a great degree many of these faiths are the direct outgrowth of ideas and teachings which have apparently vanished in their own homeland, that they are no longer available in the place where they came from, and that by degrees they have moved away into these other groups. But Pike points out, if all of these other groups hold certain doctrines, ideas, or principles in common, And all these groups have a certain dependency, which is obvious in their ritualism, obvious in their symbolism, obvious even in their languages. Then the various productions which arise as the result of this central force must have within themselves some more than incidental borrowings, some more than incidental fragments of the original teaching. Thus, Pike, beginning, for example, by studying the Kabbalah and the ancient writings in the Valley of the Euphrates, moving into Hinduism and Buddhism, going down into Egyptian philosophy, and finally over into Greek philosophy, particularly the Orphic and Pythagorean schools, he finds in all of these groups indications that a tradition of some kind, a tradition no longer directly available, even in the Persian religion, came from Persia, or came from that general area, and that this tradition, carried to a dozen other localities, has survived in all of these localities. Therefore, at least potentially, it must be assumed that they were also in the original locality, which was the source of these migratory procedures. Pike, then, in his researches, was seeking for the evidence of what he regarded as the essential principles of the wisdom religion. He was convinced that when he refers to the wisdom religion, he is referring to something that had a valid existence. He is not merely speaking in his thinking of an abstract symbolic term. He is thinking that there was, at a remote time, a highly organized faith, a more or less complete or total structure of religious insight. That this religious insight was not theological primarily, but completely philosophical and scientific. In other words, he is probing for what the alchemists in the Middle Ages called the exact science of human salvation. He believes that such a science existed, that this science was just exactly as orderly and inevitable as mathematics, and that the regeneration of man is a process for which there is an exact methodology. That this methodology underlies the so-called claims, or to some people, pretensions, of ancient peoples to possess this knowledge. And Pike is convinced that men of the caliber of Socrates and of Plato and of Pythagoras and many others in other parts of the world could not have been deceived in this matter. That these men were aware that religion divides into two distinct parts, that the core of it, the essential part of it, is this sacred science, which he calls the wisdom religion, and that the second part of it was the sacerdotal art, or the theological aspect, which had as its perhaps its prominent and most important function that of the ethical development of man. Pike therefore goes on to take the position that it was the purpose of this twofold structure to continue to bring to the attention of men, of mortal persons, the tremendous need for the enlightenment, improvement, and perfection of themselves. That the outer part of this, or the exoteric body of religion, consisted of a great group of moral, ethical virtues. Virtues founded in purification, consecration, devotion. And that the individual who accomplished to a great degree these matters was entitled, as he points out in the early Persian lore, to seek and find one of the holy teachers, the good ones, who could show him the way to that which was locked behind the veil of the inner teaching. Thus, the virtues constituted the probationary part of religion. That the living of the good life, the thinking of the good thought, these qualities made man ready to know. Because by means of these qualities, man claimed the moral birthright of his own humanity. Man stood up then and said, I am worthy. I have proved my worthiness. But Pike does not believe that religion ends in the proof of worthiness. This is important. It is the beginning. But that the good man is not the complete and total purpose of religion. That the purpose of religion is that it shall take over in some mysterious way the good man and make him the truly wise man. And that the wise man in this case is the individual who has received the secrets of the divine life. The secret of the release of his own godhood, and the secret of the means by which he will ultimately be restored to unity with the total divinity of life and space. That this has to be an exact process. That hoping, believing will help, but that just as hoping and believing will not allow an inexperienced man to perform a delicate piece of surgery, or even a great and devout believing will enable a man who has never played the piano to become instantly a musician. So hope and believing are not in themselves substitutes for actual knowledge. That they are the moral forces by which man is sustained in his search for knowledge. But that this knowledge stands apart. To attain this purpose then, Pike begins to search what he calls the monuments of time, to discover whether his position is valid. In his work on the Indo-Aryans that we have just mentioned, Pike says in the preface that this monograph was never intended for publication. It represented only his own research, and it was not published until many years after his death. It was simply the record, the daily record of his own searching. He came finally to the conclusion that the evidence in favor of the original concept was irrefutable. And that this evidence perhaps is nowhere as obvious as it is in this circle, this diameter of the wheel, in which the various nations of the world all indicate that they shared with him this absolute conviction that there was a universal knowing, a universal wisdom reality, and that this universal wisdom reality was certainly of far greater antiquity than we are normally inclined to suspect. Searching further in this field, Pike's felt conclusively necessary that we begin to push back the historical boundaries of what we term the era of light. Instead of assuming that light came to this world 3,000 years ago, or 4,000 years ago, or that man became a sapient creature 5,000, 6,000, 10,000 years ago, that we have to begin to push back this search for the origin of the enlightened man. Actually, it was Pike's conviction that man as man was created or fashioned or came into existence, whether by evolutionary or other processes, that the human being from the beginning possessed the instinct of intelligence. That this instinct of intelligence, gradually developing over a great period of time, accomplished far more in its so-called early phases than we are inclined to suspect. Pike rejects actually and completely the emergence of an enlightened man 7,000 or 8,000 years ago. Even though we cannot, by means of any existing historical record, discover the rational pre-Egyptian, the rational pre-Greek, the rational pre-Semite. Pike insists that this being existed, or that these beings existed, and that actually the streams of our tradition are far older than we suspect, and what we call history is nothing but the record of the decline of truth. Now, the reason why it is a record of the decline of truth is that it, like the history of a man, is a long unfolding record of his death. Because that part of his history, which is concerned primarily with his life, actually occurs before he is born. In his prenatal period, man is growing. From the moment he is born, he is dying. The moment birth takes over, the forces of crystallization begin to set in. And in this process of gradual dying, man passes through varying degrees of death process. When he achieves what we call maturity, he has come to the fine point of the equilibrium between life and death. In that period, therefore, we regard him as having a maximum maturity and a maximum efficiency. But what do we mean? We mean that by the time he is 35 to 45 years of age, he has reached the point where his materiality is becoming established and his spirituality is already three-quarters dead. We are coming to the point where through compromise of principles, he is making economic progress that is satisfactory. He has already died out of something. He has died out of the dreams of youth. He has died out of a great many hopes. He is becoming factual, which is another term for crystallized. Therefore, the history of our peoples, the history of the world as we know it, is the gradual process of man dying. Now, it cannot be a total picture because men are forever being born. But a moment an institution, a system, an ideological structure comes into existence, that moment it begins to die. So we have the long record of things fading away. And the things that fade first are the memories, apparently, of old things, of first things. Because in the struggle of life, we forget the dreams of youth. So by degrees, we reintegrate or reorganize our concepts, becoming ever more practical, ever more factual, discarding as lore, legend, and fairy tale things that were once the real values of our lives. Thus, we have at the root of history legendary and lore, golden ages and mysterious heavenly abodes. And as we got wiser and wiser, which means in this case deader and deader, we began to forget these things and lose them. First thing you know, we began to say these legends are for children. But children are the young, children are the alive. Therefore, there is an aliveness gradually fading away. And Pike makes a long and careful study of this aliveness. He makes a very painstaking research to show why and how each generation has persecuted the prophet. How each generation has little by little revised and restored and reinterpreted and reintegrated, and every time it did it, something was lost. Until finally, great things were reduced to the ignorance of man, which is the exact reverse of our basic process. Instead of man rising to greatness, he drew greatness down to himself until it became less and less great. And the less great it became, the more willingly he accepted it. But when it reached a certain degree of not being great, it became such a caricature of itself that man began to ridicule the procedure and reject the very things which he had himself had brought about. Thus, out of the gradual degeneration of things also rose skepticism, or a general disillusionment about knowledge or the essence of fact itself. This position causes Pike to look back, and he would like to find, or would like to believe from his researches, that the great structure of this basic doctrine, was in a strange pristine purity between 7 and 10,000 years before the beginning of the Christian era, perhaps much longer. But he wants to be as conservative as he can. He believes that this revelation, this basic knowledge, preceded the first of the Zoroasters. He believed that they drank at its fountain as all others did. He believes very definitely that the entire philosophy of the Zoroastrian doctrine is rooted in this thing, which, like the mysterious principle at the root of Zoroastrianism itself, an absolute, an infinite, an ultimate and utter state of existence, that this eternal life itself was man's primordial symbol of eternal wisdom, that this mysterious power at the very source of things, Ahura Mazda, or whatever level, he goes beyond and behind that concept also, but that this creating power, the source of all wisdom, the one who communicates to his saints and sages, the mysterious power that is forever the oracle, was not merely the voice of a deity, not merely something that appeared in thunders, but was actually a statement of the existence of a holy order, a sacred body of enlightened beings, human by nature, with a strange but total penetration into reality. And that everything that has since followed has come from that, and has gradually, in the course of time, fallen away from that, until we have relatively forgotten the original teachings of the ancient ones of the earth. Now let us see how Pike would proceed with this, because he realized that he would be open to criticism for such a statement. He would realize that someone would say, but these persons could not have known this, they could not have known that. Certainly we have made some advancements in knowledge. Certainly as we look back, we find indication of man living in a more and more primitive state. Certainly the whole trend of our concept is that man has arisen from darkness into light. Pike, however, doesn't think so. Pike says man has fallen from light into darkness because of a false estimation of what constitutes light, or perhaps a false definition of the meaning of darkness. Whichever term you wish to use, man has come to a false explanation of the meaning of the term, or a false concept of origin based upon it. He assumes that man naturally was endowed with faculties for the purpose of experiencing truth, and not for the purpose of fighting ignorance. That until man himself created ignorance, it did not exist. For ignorance is an artificial state in nature. Ignorance is not necessary. It originates in false instruction. It originates in systems by means of which man's intuitive and natural faculties are blunted, in which he loses the capacity for the immediate apprehension of fact, and must therefore depend for knowledge upon sharing the opinions of others. Pike therefore refers to these ancient ones of the earth as the lodge of the old teachers, the holy ones of old, those to whom we have constant reference. And he points again to his circumference, and he points out that every religion and philosophy of man traces itself back to a period of legendary and lore when wisdom was universal. In other words, we can think perhaps of the Greek just as a simple example. But in the beginning was the golden age, when there was no poverty, no ignorance, no sickness, no suffering, and no death. This was the divine era. In the ancient childhood of the world, in the oldest Hindu writings, we find originally this world ruled benevolently and eternally by the gods. There was no disobedience, there was no sin. Although the point is rather congested in the opening chapters of Genesis, this point also exists, that presumably the original man lived in a paradisical garden, and here the Lord walked with him in the evening, and he was not ashamed, and he was in communication with the creating powers that had fashioned him and brought him into existence. The same is true of the Egyptian religion, for in the dawn of things there was the golden age, the age of peace and joy, the age before the gods retired to their Olympian strongholds, the age in which nothing but life and peace and happiness prevailed. We find it even among savage people. We find it among our American Indian tribes. For in most of their little local legends, although they are feeble in comparison to the great theological systems of the classical nations, they all begin with the idea that man was happy. They none of them begin with the fact that he was miserable. Nearly all of the systems, and Pike enumerates probably 20 or 30 of them, they all declare that man began in peace, that for thousands of years, millions of years, perhaps aeons of time, there were no wars. Then in one way or another, rebellion set in. There was war in heaven. Some of the angels resisted their Lord. And there was the battle between Michael and Lucifer in the old Jewish legendary. Someone became selfish. Someone became corrupt. And the great and splendid pageantry of the divine will was mutilated and deformed and in measure destroyed by the rise of human will. And man's own egoism, his own selfishness, his own determination to live his own way gradually caused the golden age to die. Pike's one point, however, is well taken, that if we accept that legendary and mythology and lore belongs to a kind of subconscious memory of man, a memory which psychology perhaps says goes back to human infancy with its irresponsibility, but this again only symbolic of collective infancy, the rise and dawn of peoples, he is correct in assuming, at least, that all of the great systems of the world agree on this point. They agree that there was a time when man knew, that Adam could name all creatures according to their natures and their attributes, that the ancient ones communicated with mankind, and in practically every great system of legendary, in the dawn of things, gods walked the earth with men. We do not know just exactly how this is explained in things like the Eldorado, or the Sigurd Saga, or the Fridolf Saga, or the Kalevala, or any of these great epical works based upon the ancient legendary and lore of peoples. We have it in Japan, and the Nohinji and the Kojiki. We have the great sacred writings of the days when the gods ruled the world and men lived in peace. Thus, in the root of things, Pike seemingly took the attitude that all this legendary and lore did not relate merely to a theological abstraction or to some mythological hope or some escape mechanism in man, but that it related distinctly and definitely to a period in which the ancient doctrines, the great wisdom, was directly available to the human being. Directly available to him because he then possessed, by the nature of infancy, the total kind of purity, the total kind of innocence, by means of which he was without sin. Meaning, of course, if we want to go back to the Chaldean and follow Pike's thinking, without sin means not moonstruck, because Sin was the ancient goddess of the moon. Therefore, without lunacy, without the moon madness, without this strange thing that led man into illusion, for which the moon was an ancient symbol. Regardless of how we want to think of it, let's see how Pike now begins to defend his position. He defends his position by pointing out that as each of the streams left this central core land and began to establish themselves as separate nations and peoples, began to cause the rise of what we might term existence on an individualized basis, that the first thing that each of these groups did was to restore or recreate or perpetuate what he is referred to by Socrates in this quotation which I read, the state mysteries. Now, the state mysteries lie not at the decadence of people, but at their roots. For by the time of the Orphics, 1400 years B.C., the great mysteries of the Greeks were already in decline. By the rise of the Osirian cycle in Egypt, the great mysteries of the Egyptians had fallen, been revised, reformed, regenerated, and fallen again a dozen times. Pike is of the assumption that somewhere in the background of this great Indo-Aryan or Iranian-Aryan culture was the archetype of the great house of the mysteries. That this great house of the mysteries was not necessarily a temple, was not necessarily a great building, but whatever it was, Pike was convinced that it represented an assembly or an aggregate of enlightened and informed persons who at that time were responsible for the great pattern which was to arise in the religious and philosophic and even scientific worlds. Inasmuch as the roots of all knowledge were in this core, even though the knowledge itself was as yet undeveloped by man. If Pike is correct, and he gives a great deal of supporting evidence that is rather difficult to refute, to say the least, then he takes the position that the great sages, the great scholars, and he wisely points out that these words that we use now have no real meaning in this pattern, that it represents a quality or a condition of enlightened beings totally different from our concept of the term enlightened beings, because we're using our own words for something else. But the best we can say is that there existed a core of knowers whose knowledge was real, whose knowledge was relatively, at least, absolute, whose knowledge exceeded that of any age that has followed them, and that the whole great search is the effort to recover it. Pike, therefore, tells us in his belief that the great orders of mediators, or the great personal mediator between God and nature, is always symbolic of these ancient ones of the earth and of the institution which they created, by means of which they captured the fire of heaven and made it available to man. They did not capture the full flame. They did not take all the fires from the sky to light their altars. They lit their altars and the great fire remained. But the little fire upon their own altar was the symbol of a strange and mysterious comradeship, or a strange and mysterious relationship between the fire and the total flame, between the light and the total sun. What then happened to the ancient body, this mysterious structure? Plato, I think, gives us a clue to this in the story of the lost Atlantis. For in a strange way, the Atlantic Empire was a symbol of something. The great king of Atlantis, according to Plato, was Atlas, who has later become known as the man who carries the heavens on his shoulders. In other words, the ancient thing, the old world, disappearing in the waters of time and illusion, the submerged continent that went to sleep in the deep. This strange submergence is actually a kind of deluge in which truth was drowned with error. Yet truth, lying beneath the surface of error, becomes the very foundation of restoration. Though the lost world of antiquity has simply been drowned into another kind of world. It has never ceased. It has simply been submerged. As man developed, his external propensities and powers, his psychic and mystical propensities retired more and more deeply into himself. They apparently were lost, like a lost continent. The soul was lost in the body, but the soul did not die. It remained hidden beneath the surface of things. Truth was lost in error, but truth did not die. It is merely concealed by the veil of error drawn across its face, or at least it is drowned in a water of illusion, but it lies like the ancient city beneath the surface of the ocean, that men could look down and see the roofs. So Pike tells us in his thinking that beneath the surface, the great association of the light still functions. And he believed that at some remote period, maybe 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, the first revelations of this ancient body that we know of, the first revelations flowed into Persia and flowed into the Indo-Gangetic plain, and that therefore that the two great structures, the Avestas and the Vedas, constitute perhaps the earliest and most total revelation of this thing that all men are still seeking. He was convinced that then the streams continued to flow, flowing into many directions, and that in all these flowings there was a root in reality, but that as the streams flowed forth, mixed and mingled, passed over various types of earth and gathered impurities, their currents became abrupted and broken, rapids came, the waters were muddy and defiled, and in the end, men used these streams merely to till their fields rather than to redeem their souls, and that the great stream of this faith gradually disappeared into the earth like water after rain until man can no longer find it, and that in the place of it he has a great group of secondary institutions built upon the ethical phases of the ancient faith but without the keys to its ancient doctrine. In discussing the subject of the Zoroastrian fire principle, Pike also comes to certain conclusions that he regards as very important. He tells us, deriving much of his thinking from his own acquaintance with transcendental magic, he tells us that fire is not only a symbol of deity, not only a symbol of purification, not only a symbol of light, not only an emblem of the sun, it is more than any and all of this. Fire is the symbol of the great chemical agent. Fire is the symbol of the power that works the great alchemical regeneration. Fire is actually, therefore, the tremendous agent, the master builder. Fire is represented in some legendary in the heroic figure of Tubal-Cain, the ironmonger, the man who is able to pound the swords into plowshares. Fire is the temperer of iron. And by means of it, iron is hardened into steel, and from this steel is fashioned the sword Notong, the sword of the Volsungen. It is also the sword Excalibur, the mysterious sacred emblem of the Arthurian cycle. And it is also the sword of Damocles, hanging over the banquet of Dionysus of Syracuse, the sword suspended by a single hair, which can fall and destroy man. It is the two-edged sword coming out of the mouth of the great figure of Revelation. It is the sword, the golden blazing sword of the cherubs guarding the gates of Eden. This sword is a flame. This flame is itself a symbol of the great art, the tremendous science, by means of which all things passing through the fire are made new. There is a strange meaning. This fire is also the light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. This fire, which burns forever upon the altar of the human being, is the fire of life, the fire in the blood, the fire in the heart, which is truly the altar, the living altar of the soul. But this fire to Pike was a symbol by means of which he was convinced that the signatura rerum, the seal, the true signature of the great order, which lay at the root of things, was stamped upon the ancient peoples who worshipped it, knowing why they worshipped, knowing the mystery of fire, knowing, as the ancient Rosicrucians knew, how to make fire burn in water, and how to make water feed fire as a fuel. That behind all of this was the statement of the science that later came into existence in alchemy, in Hermetic philosophy, in Kabbalism, in Buddhism, in the Vedanta, in the yogic doctrines of Patanjali. The fire, this mysterious power, which if it be lifted up and subjected to the rules of science, will draw all things unto it. Therefore, that by the fire was now meant the operative mystery of truth. That while many things are speculative, the fire, by its own virtue and its own symbol, becomes the difference between the fire of truth and the coal light of intellect. That it becomes the power of the universe made available to man so that he may see in the night of his own ignorance. This is then the mysterious fire of the Samadhi and the Nirvana of Buddhism. But this fire is now surrounded by a series of other fires that have been lighted by its torch. And wherever this fire springs up, it seems to tell us that the one torch lit it. And this circumference of fires, gradually spreading on and on, like the mysterious campfires in the sky of the ancient Sioux warrior waiting for death, these fires going on have created roads or paths, because the way they traveled becomes a road for anyone who wishes to travel back. Consequently, in all parts of the world, there is pilgrimage. Pilgrimage back to the Father Fountains, back to the parent fire. And around the fire is a wall, a great structure to protect the holy place, like the strange walls around the tabernacle in the wilderness. Walls have been built to guard the sanctuary, that the profane may not enter. And these walls, in Pike's thinking, are the walls of faiths. That they are not actually enemies of the fire. They are guardians. They stand almost like armed cherubs, guarding the 12 gates to the holy land of truth. And these cherubs with flaming swords will not permit the uninitiated to enter into the sacred ground. Therefore, these religions have gradually become systems of discipline. They have become ways of purification. They have become the pronaos of the temple, the outer part, the porch. And no one can enter the sanctuary who does not first pass through the porch to be challenged by the guardians like those who entered the ancient Egyptian mysteries. And unless they have the right word, unless they are able to prove their fitness to go on, the door does not open, and they remain outside. Only those who are permitted to pass these gates have right of entry. Pike points out in 1878 that it's a little a pity that religions have not recognized this very significant point, that they, like the flaming cherubs, are the guardians of something superior to them all. And that therefore, this idle controversy as to which one is the holiest among them is one of the worst wastes of time in history, and furthermore, the greatest cause of cruelty perhaps the world has ever known. That in attempting to vie with each other, they have forgotten that they were created to stand guard. They were created as gates, leading not to themselves, but through themselves, to that which was the substance of them all. That discovering this substance, that man was then, perhaps more than ever before, capable of being grateful to the paths that he had walked. So these gates become the natural doors, the mysterious 12 gates in the city of the New Jerusalem. And through these gates men can move. But these gates are each of them marked with tests, with trials, with obligations. And these obligations are not, as we have been told or have been taught to think, that they are not the arbitrary dictates of a deity who tells us that we must go hungry when we want to eat, or that we must be miserable in order to be virtuous. That is not the concept at all. These trials exist for only one purpose, namely that they represent the undergraduate work in the University of Truth. We have to face them as such. The trial is given to us not because we are sinners, or we are born in sin and conceived in iniquity. The trial is given to us because we are truth seekers. And in order to achieve the truth we seek, we must become the truth we seek. Therefore, these tests, these trials, these disciplines are absolutely indispensable to those who would approach the flame. For if those who approach the flame are not so disciplined, so that the dross in their own natures has not been voluntarily removed, then they approach the flame with combustible material and will find not the light of ages, but a consuming fire, because the dross cannot survive the flame. Therefore, it is the duty of man to remove the dross before he approaches the flame. If not, the experience is painful rather than helpful. So ethics represents merely the outer shadow, the exoteric name for discipline. Men do not do these things for the benefit of each other. They do not do these things primarily, actually, for the benefit of themselves as persons. They do these things in the name of and in the cause of the truth, without which they cannot live or survive. So Pike points out that in his estimation, that circle of ancient guardians actually existed. And by degrees, through the passing of time, we have forgotten that they were indeed a circle guarding a sacred place. And because that thing which was in the center of that place was not a vast cathedral built by men, was not a wonderful holy city leaving 10 layers of ruin for us to excavate, but because that thing in the center was mostly life, pure life, it was easy to forget it, because we couldn't see anything with our objective senses. We could not sense the magnitude unless we achieved it. Thus the center gradually ceased to exist as far as we are concerned. Our own ignorance caused us to miss the implication entirely. And we began to make each of these gates centers in themselves. And we had many centers, therefore many faiths, rather than many gates to one. Then, of course, followed the general confusion of tongues, confusion of minds, and confusion of souls, and it became possible for men to kill each other in the name of God. It became possible for them to persecute each other in the name of truth, because the center was gone. And without that center, each thing standing by itself alone was inadequate, unreal, imperfect. The loss of the consciousness of the center made it possible for us to be fanatics, made it possible for us to be bigots. Whereas the realization of that center would have preserved the great and magnificent geometrical harmony of the divine plan. Having missed the point, we did not, however, miss it without some redeeming factors that we realized it, because these gates were originally created with the correct purpose. Pike is convinced that they were. And he is also convinced that these gates, when in the course of ages a faith failed or a religion ceased, and therefore a gate was left untended, that immediately out of the structure of the general pattern, new gatekeepers came, who were also to remain the custodians of these gates. Therefore, all religions were not founded at exactly the same time as separate sects. They might be founded over a period of 20,000 years. Yet still, actually, they are those gates. In those days, this relationship between these groups was not hopelessly lost. They had not become creed-bound. They had not said, "My God against thy God." Or they already had achieved and had maintained, as Pythagoras tells us, the realization that in all the various areas that he visited, and he visited over 20 of the great religious systems of Europe, the Near East, the Far East, and North Africa, that they all taught the same doctrine and they all knew it. And that was as late as 550 BC. They knew it. And yet, in these intervening 2,400 years, this knowledge has been generally lost. So we have an interesting evidence that knowledge has gotten lost even after history has been able to record it. Pike is therefore convinced, and I think he has a very strong story in his behalf, that this knowledge of being waves leading in to this great central fire core, this knowledge existed, probably generally known, as late as Plato and Socrates, perhaps a little later. Less generally, but somewhat widely known, as late as the 6th century A.D., still known in some areas to the present time, but comparatively unknown to what we call Western culture. That this factor is known in Asia and in North Africa, I have reason to believe. I discussed some of these problems with some very learned Copts in Cairo, and they assured me that these facts were fully known to them. But these peripheral groups, almost untouched by the rapid so-called progress of the Western way of life, These are not listened to anymore, any more than are a few of the learned Sufis and dervishes who also know, nor certain of the very learned Taoist and Zen monks who also know. These things are not totally unknown. They are totally ignored by the majority of Western peoples. But the concept leads into the next important point, and that is that from the ancient mysteries, we have by natural heritage, as Pike points out, in incorporating part of this ritualism and symbolism into the Scottish degrees of Freemasonry, Pike points out that into this modern knowledge, and we can read it in Iamblichus on the Mysteries, in Proclus on the Theology of Plato, in the Eleusinian and Bacchic Mysteries, the Mysteries of Mithras, and many others, that these rituals are what we might term the gates, are still known. That there is this gate, a doctrine of awareness, the Zen concept of the mystery of the gateless gate. That this gate knowledge is still available. And Pike points out that it will always remain the same. In one generation it may be forgotten and another remembered. Perhaps sometime Vishnu must be born again to bring the law out of the depths of the ocean where it had been stolen away by giants. But regardless of what happens to the law remains. And man must come finally to the old road that leads to the law. And these ancient institutions, the mysteries, gradually bestowed part of their insight, but only a part, upon the rising theological systems that succeeded them in most areas. But each time this transmission was made, something was obscured by a heavier layer of symbols, until it became less and less easy to see the facts. But Pike points out that once you possess the key, not necessarily the great key that unlocks all truths, but now merely the point of view, which is the key, the discrimination to recognize landmarks, as some of the Freemasonic brethren call them, if we can see and recognize the landmarks, we will recognize the fact that no faith has ever been without them. We can also recognize that in every generation, in every religion, a few have recognized them and have quietly gone into this quiet search along the mysterious thread of Ariadne that led out of the labyrinth of confusion into the broad light of common sense. Out of all this consideration, then, Pike tells us, the essential remains. The mysteries, as we knew them then, have mostly fallen ruin in time. They have, however, bestowed themselves as moral forces and as intangible but real values upon those things that succeeded them. And these, in turn, have, in one way or another, perpetuated, often without knowing it, certain peculiar doctrines, certain particular arrangement of emblems and patterns, whether in music, in art, in literature, or architecture, or scripture, science, philosophy, religion, these different groups have all perpetuated the key. The only problem is to find it, to get it out again. And the key, there's always the road that leads to the gate. And at the gate, through the mystery of initiation, supplies the pass sign, by means of which the individual can pass into the ancient temple, where he can come finally into the sanctum sanctorum, or the adytum of the house. The great central place, in which stands alone the flaming symbol of the eternal.
Thus, the search is for this, and Pike, being a scholar in these things and a great researcher, realizes that the secret societies of the ancients were therefore the elementary schools, so to say, leading into this knowledge, that their primary purpose was to give man the moral and ethical indoctrination by which he became capable of discriminating value, by means of which he could finally say with Omar, referring to the mysterious dances of the dervishes, Omar says, "From my base metal shall be filed the key that shall unlock the door they howl without." And that is the problem. The purpose of these systems of religion extended from the mystery systems is to proceed to the regeneration of man within certain limits, the gradual restoration of the good word, the good deed, and the good thought, the gradual beginning of the purification of the individual, by which, through the cultivation of the upright life, through the actual practice of self-control and self-discipline, through the application of proper principles to every action of conduct, the individual gradually gains the first thing that he needs, namely the power to govern himself, the power to dedicate himself, the power to place value above profit in everything, the power to choose self-sacrifice before the proclamation of truth, the power gradually to make the recognition of the value of reality strong enough to impel the person to go forward to the attainment of that which he has discovered. It is not from hope of heaven or from fear of hell that man must develop virtue. He must develop it because without it, he cannot sufficiently regenerate his own organism so that he is capable of the great mystery ritual of truth seeking. Pike therefore points out that having passed through a certain tempering in the lesser fires, the spirit is strengthened, the resolution is strengthened, the individual gains gradual control of the mind and the emotions and the body, until finally, through self-discipline, he is capable of attaining that internal integration, which is peace, which is security in the true sense of the word. And that as one in peace with all things, including himself, at in total peace with the world and with life and with reality, the individual thus completely at peace may pass through into the mysterious room beyond to find himself in the mysterious sanctuary of the ancient ones of the earth. He will then realize that he indeed has walked the path that all those who were truth-seeking, wise and good before him, have also walked. That he is walking the path of light. That he is therefore entering into the true religion. That he is seeking the everlasting fire and is finding it, and is satisfied to become the servant of that flame. And in so doing, he attains not to knowledge in the common sense. He attains rather to identity with primordial knowing. He participates in the fact of truth, as did ancient man before ignorance, sin, and death came into his world. And because man has overcome ignorance, sin, and death in himself, he then becomes also one of those ancient ones who is timeless, who belongs to the order of the mediators and becomes truly educated, truly enlightened, truly wise. This is the only wisdom there is. There is no other. And all the search for worldly wisdom leads in the end either to total disillusionment or else total dedication to that which is true.
My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon as well as through various other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. As always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.